Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
I'm good. I'm getting into the swing of things, having a routine at home and working from the kitchen table, which is quite a weird phenomenon for me because I'm not someone that actually spends much time in my kitchen ever. And today's guest, we are having a very early Talk Art meeting, and I'm super excited because I have wanted to talk to her for a long time because I feel like she's someone that really unites people and brings people together from different backgrounds and different industries in the kind of goal of helping promote creativity and art, and has had an amazing career and is now the leader of the greatest museum in the UK, in my opinion.
If not the world.
But
yes.
Only probably because I'm a Londoner, but also because I love St. Ives. And the Tate galleries are just transformative, and also an international kind of destination now for people all over the world. So I'm very excited. I heard her give a speech at Tate St. Ives when Rebecca Warren opened the new galleries there a year or so ago. And I was blown away by just the words she chose to use. And I felt like she really, you know, made everyone in the room feel welcome and part of this kind of major moment for Tate St. Ives. And I'm really excited to speak to her. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Maria Bowshaw.
Thank you, guys. I think that's the nicest introduction I have probably ever had.
Really?
Oh, well, it's deserved.
Yeah,
totally
absolutely.
Totally deserved. How does this find you, Maria? How are you at the moment?
I am managing in isolation quite well. And I'm in Kent, and I have a garden outside me, which is feels like a real luxury at the moment. And I'm running the four Tates from my kitchen counter. I mean, that is a new experience.
Yeah.
But it's but it turns out it's possible. And colleagues across the four Tates, there's nearly 1,400 of them. They have been amazing. Turning from being open to being closed and working at home and moving online and still sharing all the art we have with our public with incredible speed in this context of real uncertainty. So I am on a daily basis struck with awe about the wonderful colleagues I have.
Amazing. Well, we're just going to say about the four Tates. We've got the Tate Britain and the Tate Modern that are in London. Then we have Tate St. Ives in Cornwall. And we have Tate Liverpool.
Liverpool, yeah.
They're the four Tates that are all around the country. So are you finding a massive rush of audiences going online now to the Tate? Because you've got quite an amazing setup and the content that the Tate offers the public, right?
Yeah. There's been a huge spike in numbers on the website, and most especially for children. So, I mean, quietly and every day, Tate does loads with school-aged children and with families. We had this lovely part of our website called Tate Kids. Now, we've seen a 5,000% increase in engagement.
5,000%?
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And the first weekend when we were all told to stay at home, there's a bit of the Tate Kids site that is a gallery for children, and they can use the a paint tool to make works of art themselves. And over 2 days, 1,500 artworks were uploaded to the site. And I mean, they're beautiful. I've been looking at them every day.
Oh, so there's like an online gallery of the work.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see Tate's kind of local importance, but also its international reach, because there's kids in Singapore, all across the US. We had a huge spike in interest in Turkey because people were locked down there, but they were looking for creative things to do. Although it's incredibly sort of gratifying, it doesn't surprise me because we're in these strange times. And I think what art helps us do is wrestle with uncertainty. And probably the nicest consequence of having more time at home is that we remember that we need to play a bit and to kind of imagine a better world. So you'll see on the kids' gallery loads and loads of paintings of rainbows.
They're
and
all
sun
really
coming
hopeful,
out.
Right.
Yeah, they really are. When it isn't that kind of, oh my God, we're going into an apocalypse. Mm. It is, I'm going to remember that I'm a creative individual, and I can make things, and I can imagine the world being different.
Yeah. And actually, you, in the 1990s, did a lot of education work, which might surprise some people, because I actually didn't know that about you. But you were a lecturer in cultural studies and also taught at University of Birmingham, as well as doing research yourself. So do you think that kind of early part of your kind of career has helped to inform how you then approach running museums like the Whitworth and the Tate?
Most definitely. And although that it's still quite unusual to have somebody running an institution like Tate that didn't sort of train for that for their whole life.
Yeah.
But so much of the purpose of museums these days is about educating in the kind of kindest sense,
mm-hmm. you know,
opening our minds to the different ways that artists look at the world and giving us the tools, I think, to imagine the world differently. And I think I was very lucky. I was thinking about this last night. When I went to university, I went to Liverpool. So Tate Liverpool was the first Tate that I knew. And in fact, then I definitely considered it my own gallery because it opened in 1988, just a couple of months before I arrived in the city as a student. And I'd grown up in Northampton and there were no galleries there. There was an old museum, but there were no contemporary galleries. So I'd gone to Birmingham and I'd gone to London to try and find art. So I arrive in Liverpool and this amazing gallery is walking distance from my university. So that's where I first learned to look at art. And I'd signed up for a quite conventional English literature and language degree. Mm-hmm. And I really liked what you said earlier, Robert, about words, because I love words. And I think that's part of my early training in literature. So it's important to me that we use rich and beautiful language. But the degree that I did was quite conventional. And I hadn't gone to university to be conventional. So in my first year, I discovered that there was this other program that was called Cultural and Communication Studies. So I swapped out of doing English language into that with my English literature bit, which was very good for me because I really hated English language. And I have to say my grammar is still less than perfect because I didn't stick with that side of my degree. But the cultural studies bit sort of immersed me in every kind of creativity. So we were taught anthropology, we were taught psychoanalysis, we were encouraged to look at films and music. I remember writing one of my final year essays on the Pet Shop Boys and the collaboration that they'd made in videos with Derek Jarman. And yes. I got a first for that essay, which I did not get for my not very good essay on Pre-Raphaelite poetry. So kind of embracing wider popular and visual culture really suited me.
We've just got to say the congratulations with the Derek Jarman, like the Save Prospect Cottage in Dungeness that literally got announced the last couple of days, that the 3.5 million that was needed to be raised to protect it for the nation going forwards as a centre of activity for culture and you, your involvement in that was massive, has just been a huge success, which is like a ray of light in the current climate.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm so pleased. And I mean, really, the credit sits with Stephen Dutcher at the Art Fund, who has led a most amazing campaign.
Yes.
And what Tate will do is hold the materials that are so fragile that they need to be in our archive at Tate Britain. Mm-hmm. But also, it was a personal campaign for me because, as I say, I watched Jarman's films when I was a teenager on Channel 4, and rather like Olivia Lang, the critic and writer, writes beautifully about Derek's work. Mm-hmm. And she's the same age as me. And I think both of us were 13 and were sneaking down after our parents had gone to bed to watch the films. And what those films gave then in the middle of the 1980s was the sense that life could be different from the kind of not very nice life we were experiencing as teenagers. Yeah. You know, my parents were lovely, but it was the middle of the Thatcher era, and it didn't feel very welcoming to creative young people. Mm-hmm. So Derek's been a lifelong inspiration for me. And I'm a gardener, and I love Dungeness. I mean, a bleak, shingly beach that goes on forever, that is my idea of heaven.
Did you ever meet him? Did you ever meet Derek Jarman?
I saw him speak. I was a bit too young and much too scared to go and speak to him in those days. So he was kind of an idol who I admired from afar. I'd have loved, and I now know lots of people who did know him really, really well, and I wish I had met him.
Wow.
But sort of he was part of what was why I think I was lucky at university, because what I was able to study in the end was the beginnings of the world changing fundamentally. So I wasn't taught that art only lives in a frame or in a piece of sculpture. Mm-hmm. I was taught about understanding the whole visual world, and I was taught queer theory and feminism and psychoanalysis and weird French theory, and all of that kind of set in me both a questioning of the accepted canons. So I never thought it was okay that, you know, the definition of an artist was a male artist. I was always looking for those women artists, those queer artists who were always there, but you know, weren't part of the mainstream then. Yeah. And I feel very lucky to have grown up through and spent, you know, a decade teaching strange things like, you know, a Wednesday morning lecture on Blur's Park Life as a way of thinking about Britishness and identity. And I love that I have that as part of my background, mm-hmm. because that's about a deeply democratic connection to artistic production. And so I've always been interested in what used to be called high culture and popular culture, and mm-hmm. and that's just all very relevant for Tate now and for what we think art should count, what we now know it can be.
Mm-hmm. You've been an amazing champion for female artists throughout your career, and there's the legacy that you created at the Whitworth Museum in Manchester when you were there is just phenomenal and legendary, and you had some amazing artists in there, and that what you have done, what you achieved there was just wonderful. And there's an artist I'd like to talk about, was when you had, because we're big fans on Talk Eyes, Marina Abramovich, when she took over the Whitworth, and what her process was and what she kind of asked and how that was achieved.
I'm working with her was a huge learning experience for me. And again, she was somebody that I'd just read about in books, because in the 80s and 90s, she wasn't performing in the UK. And by and large, UK culture kind of wasn't the epicentre of live art and performance. Although when I lived in Birmingham, my dear friend Mark Ball set up and then ran brilliantly the Fierce Festival, which meant in my kind of mid-20s, I did really start to understand performance art. So a bit like Derek Jarman, Marina was one of those kind of idols for me, absolute heroes. Mm. And I moved to Manchester and was working at the Whitworth, and the international festival there had been set up by Alex Poots, who's become a really good friend of mine. And he came to see me and he said, we'd really like to do this project with Marina Abramovich. Do you know who she is? And that might seem a funny thing to say now, because, you know, Marina is so well known worldwide now. And I mean, in some ways, she was really well known from the 70s onwards, but in a very niche world. And actually, by the kind of mid-2000s, her career had kind of quite a lull, because, as she says herself, she would make amazing performances through the 70s, 80s and 90s, but people didn't record them. In some ways, it was not seen to be proper, because it was about the live moment. And she didn't have a gallery, and, you know, how do you sell live art?
Yeah. So I guess her reach was limited then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Beyond whoever was in the room at that experience, yeah.
Exactly. And she was very, very well known within the live art and performance world, and within the kind of narrowness of the art world. But she wasn't known in the global way that she is now. So Alex says, do you know her? I'm going, oh, my God. Like, I spent months and months reading about this work and looking at photographs of it in earnest kind of art magazines. And the idea that I could meet her was just so exciting. So Alex kind of, he set up, she came to visit. It was one of those very bizarre days, because I was raising my kids at the same time as working at the Whitworth. And so my lovely curator, Mary Griffiths, went and showed Marina and Hans Ulrich Obrist, who was working with us on this project, around the Whitworth, while I had to stand on a bloody touchline of a rugby match for my then probably 10-year-old son. I hate rugby. So I came back and I'd said, because I had the kids and was on my own, I'd said, come for dinner, but you have to be at home. So I rushed back, cooked dinner, tried to get some kind of trendy music lined up to play, and was just very, very nervous. Marina arrives with Alex and Hans Ulrich. We all kind of talk. And I said, so what do you think about the gallery? What do you want to do? And she said, we cannot talk about it yet. You have to have had a glass of wine first.
I think that's a good way forward, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, what on earth? Yeah, what on earth is she going to ask me? And I remember very vividly, we sat down and we had Tumani Diabati's Mandé Variation, so lovely choral music on playing. And she said, okay, now is the right moment. And said, so what do you want to do? And she said, it's what I want to undo. I said, okay. She said, you have 11 rooms in the gallery, you know, 11 gallery spaces. She said, I would like to take all of the art out. Wow. I was like, oh. She said, take the normal art out and instead put the live art. And she said this thing that stayed with me since. She said, the thing is, live art is always the thing that gets used for the opening and then it disappears.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she said, now we put the live art in the centre of the canon, the centre of the museum. And I could see Alex and Hans Ulrich looking really, really tense. And if you imagine, I mean, galleries are supposed to hang works of art.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's our purpose. And I didn't even know whether, if we took all the art out, that it would fit in the stores.
But I thought,
this is Marina Abramovich asking me. And so I just kind of calmly nodded and said, okay, yes. And then I said, maybe have to go and ask some of the team about how we do it, but yes.
And then
Marina looked really startled. And much later on, she said to me, you know that day when you said yes to the whole museum? She said, you weren't supposed to say that. She said, I said everything. You were supposed to say one room and we were supposed to meet in the middle.
Wow.
And the resulting exhibition had 14 performance artists, no? So it was like committed installation of performance work.
But they were on like schedules, like every 20 minutes they would do a performance, or every hour in that room there'd be a performance?
It was much tougher than that, Russell. And that's the thing about what I also learned from, Say Yes was one of the things I learned from Marina. And the other was be demanding. Because each day, all 14 artists performed simultaneously for 4 hours. And the audience was asked to come at the beginning. They had to come in. They had to check in their phones and cameras. They had to put on a lab coat and enter into this experiment around live art. They had to spend the first hour with Marina being drilled into how you slow down. So she made people sit on a chair and look at their neighbour, look them straight in the eye for 2 minutes, which is a very long time. And she made people sip a glass of water, a tiny glass of water, but make it last for 5 minutes. So she got people to go through this physical process to, if you like, let go of the outside world and calm down. And then the audience had to stay for the 4 hours. Wow. And we never locked the doors or kind of prevented anyone from leaving. Mm. But the strength of the invitation was such that nobody left. I mean, if we'd build it before we started as a, come on public, come for 4 hours to see a bunch of weird artists that you've never heard of who are doing strange physical things. Mm. You know, it wouldn't have flown in marketing terms.
No.
Yeah.
But what happened was that people got so intrigued about the proposition that we were sold out for 18 days, that the festival's 18 days long. So every day.
And there were 4 hour slots you'd book for that you'd be in. Right.
And that was part of the international festival, wasn't it? The Manchester Festival.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
She seems like the perfect artist for today's climate, like slowing down. We're all being forced to slow down, and she was forcing everyone at that point to slow down.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And actually, moving forward, there was a show I think you were the director of the Tate at this time, that was one of the best shows I think I've pretty much seen at the Tate, which was Anne Imhoff's performance installation. And I got invited by Sadie Coles, and she took me, and she luckily had a spare ticket, and I went with her. And, you know, I will never forget the impact that had on me. And I'd seen her 2017 Venice installation, which was amazing, and at the time I was like blown away by it. But the one at the Tate was just so immersive in and so kind of, I don't know, it just went on for hours. And it was one of the first times I've done that, where you've actually spent that kind of long time. What was it like sort of doing that? Because it's a very like kind of underground aesthetic and quite subversive in many ways to sort of bring that to a mainstream audience.
Yeah. I mean, the hairs on the back of my neck just prickled as you mentioned that, Robert, because I think it was one of my standout encounters of recent years. And I think, I mean, working on anything like that is incredibly demanding. So Catherine Woods and Akim, who lead and run the BMW Live program, had to take such extraordinary risks in order to bring that together. And again, I think the art gets created when the artist is sort of pushing at the edge of their capabilities. Mm. And so Anne was directing the piece and working in a way that had sort of significantly stretched what she had done before. So the sort of elements were to do with it being in the tanks, because those spaces anyway are just full of kind of eerie wonderfulness. The concrete, and I mean, I'm not sure whether this is really true, but whenever I'm in them, I always feel I can still smell the oil that would have been in the tanks.
Yeah.
But it's because they are still pretty much they are found industrial spaces.
Yeah.
And artists love them. And so Anne was directing both her performers and the audience through these rather uncanny spaces. And of course, she created some structure. So sometimes the performers were above us, sometimes they were behind glass, sometimes they were moving through us, and they were making sound move through the spaces in really, really incredible ways. Mm-hmm. So there was a moment that just blew me away where one of the performers was carrying a speaker and just walking quite rapidly through the crowds. And so the beautiful music was moving with their body.
Yeah.
And I think what was very special about it was this sense of, as an audience, we weren't separate from the performance, because the way Anne was working, and she was using her phone, she was texting the performers, she was making them move differently depending on where the audience were. And so the person that came in to see it was making the piece with the performers and with the artist, and that's really very unusual.
Yeah, I think it was such a interesting way to sort of create a psychological space as well, because even though those tanks already dictate so much, she actually transformed it completely with the climbing frames and even the way she used that little sort of tank chamber or something, if you know what I mean. There's a kind of like cave almost within that space. Yeah. And I don't know, it was just, and the way that no one could actually see what was inside, because there were so many people in the audience that to see through that small kind of doorway was impossible, because everyone was trying to crowd around. And you were desperate to know what was happening in every single part of the space. And you can't, you know, there might have been noises in the other rooms that you couldn't be part of, but you were getting an echo of it. It was just the most fascinating kind of, and immersive is the only word, which I don't always, kind of annoys me, that word, but it really was. It was like being in the ocean.
Oh, I love the word immersive. Doesn't know, I love an immersive experience.
No, I know, but I feel like people misuse that word now. I think people say like, oh, it's going to be an immersive exhibition. And when you get there, you're like, well, it's not really, it's just got a video on the, you know, on the wall. Right. Or something. Whereas I feel like this was actually like being floating in an ocean. Do you know what I mean? Like with loads of other people or something. It was so, all your senses were being kind of heightened and manipulated in a way. It was a fascinating exhibition.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm with you. It's not immersive if there's just a bit of moving image or some sound surrounding you. But you put your finger on it, Robert, when you say you could be in one of the tanks and you'd become aware that something was happening somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so it was like being in life as well as in art. Yeah. So that you were seeing what you're seeing and you were missing out on something. And so there was sort of this curious sense of jeopardy in the experience of seeing it. And of course, and this is the great thing about all live art, is that it was different each time because the performers were not following an absolutely rigid script. Say Anne was responding to what was going on as it unfolded. And so what you saw with Sadie would have been different to what I saw on the night that I went.
Wow. Well, the tapes were all incredible buildings. Do you ever feel there's any limitations to any of the spaces?
Well, there's so many, actually.
Oh.
I mean, they're amazing, but almost every space has certain limitations. So at Liverpool, wonderful building on the docks. And from one side, you look out across the Mersey and out to sea. It's really remarkable. But because it's an old warehouse, there are limited height in many of the gallery spaces. Mm-hmm. So in recent times, we were looking at showing some of Frank Bowling's paintings up there.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant idea. You know, so much of his work is about that, the Atlantic crossings between the UK, the Americas, the Caribbean, and so on. And then after a really excitable discussion for a couple of minutes with Helen, who's the director in Liverpool, we realised that the paintings were too big to get into the building.
Oh, God.
No way.
And so, you know, that's a particular limitation there. Environmental conditions. You know, there's also the technical issues that sit behind running museums are... you know, massive. We don't speak of them that much publicly, but working in an old power station is completely fantastic in so many ways. But it's not a naturally environmentally stable situation. So there's a constant struggle with the building management system to just keep the environment so that it wouldn't be harmful to the art. Mm-hmm. And then there are also sort of different, I always think there are, people bring different assumptions to different buildings. So Tate Britain is, you know, the original Tate. It's like the mothership. You know, when I grew up, it was the only Tate. Yeah. And it comes out of late Victorian ambition. And so it is a grand building. You know, you walk up the steps, you've got the incredible columns, you go into the huge vaulting Davine spaces. But it speaks of power. And we found, of course, over the years that that's absolutely fine for people who are comfortable coming into galleries and have been taught how to do that either through their school or through their family experience. But it's pretty intimidating if it's not part of your life experience. So you'll know, Russell, that we've been over the last 6 months doing a project with Steve McQueen called Year Three, which photographed all the 7 and 8 year olds across London and brought their school photographs into the Davines Gallery. And the thinking behind that with Steve was really about how could you make that grand building part of the life of a 7 or 8 year old, whoever they are in London? How could we make it not intimidating to come in? And that idea came out of Steve remembering being brought to Tate Britain when he was 7 by his school. And he says he still remembers running up the stairs, kind of looking up, which is what you see children do as you cross the threshold. You know, am I allowed in here? And he said what he found when he got there was were drawings and paintings. And he used to draw at home. And he said he remembers thinking, oh, I'm allowed to do that.
Oh,
that's good.
Yeah.
Amazing. And you think so. We started to think about how important it was that we made sure that generations of children growing up in London now understand that they're allowed to be artists if that's what they want to be, or they're allowed to be whoever they want to be.
Or they're allowed in these spaces. But also, if you see yourself up on the walls in an art gallery, it makes you feel like you belong anyway because you're seeing yourself represented. Yeah. You're seeing yourself there. So, of course, you're welcome. If you're there on the wall, it must be your place.
Yeah, totally. No doubt about it, because those children have become part of the national story of art.
Yeah.
And it's even taken them onto the, you know, the billboards of train stations and, you know, on the streets and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So they're kind of become part of the city. They're kind of seeing themselves represented even within the city as well, like outside of the gallery, which I also thought was a really nice part of that whole Steve McQueen show, you know, the way that it extended beyond and then also went digital as well. Like it's a really kind of whole experience. And it's interesting, that idea of representation as well, because I think it's that memory that, you know, McQueen's talking about is almost kind of a conscious memory, but also a subconscious thing that you then take away with you for the whole of your life. You know, it's like these are impressions that are lasting.
Yeah. Something happened for Steve in his childhood, you know, at school, at home, at that moment coming to Tate Britain, that helped tell him that he was allowed to go and make films and go to art school and be an artist and a filmmaker in Hollywood or in an art contest, wherever he wanted, that he kind of subconsciously read that permission.
He received
permission from the world.
Yeah.
And you're so right, Robert, about the importance of that project being across London and across the digital universe as well. I saw there were school photographs all the way along the length of Pimlico tube station. Huge billboards, because that's the closest station to Tate Britain. And one day I watched not just a couple of people, a large group of people let 3 trains go by because they were wanting to walk the length of the platform and look at the kids. And you just think, so we've kind of interrupted people's rushing across London.
You slowed them down.
That is so important. Yeah, we're on that as a theme, aren't we?
Yeah, totally.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake. So talking about representation, is there anyone in the collection you think is underrepresented, and are there any artists that you are longing to get into the collection yourself?
Well, there's been a lot of work over the last 10 years at least to rebalance the collection in terms of gender. Francis Morris, Anne Gallagher, colleagues who were at Tate before I arrived have been, you know, doing really steadfast work to rebalance, because they and we now, we inherited a collection and a canon that was, you know, largely white men. And they're great artists, but alongside them, there were always great artists who were women, who for historical and cultural reasons did not make their way into the collections. So, you know, sterling work has been done in that respect. And that same kind of imbalance is even more acute for artists who are not white, and also for artists who worked in unconventional media. So in the last few years, we've done a lot of work to reflect the incredible diversity and brilliance of Black British art from the 1980s and 90s. Mm-hmm. So I was really, really pleased that we were able to bring more work in by Sonia Boyce last year. I love her work.
And she's representing England, Great Britain at Venice next year.
Yes, she is. And last year, we get a little fund that we're able to spend in the early morning of the Frieze Art Fair to make sure that some of that work comes into public collections and has a public benefit. And one of Sonia's pieces, the extraordinary installation of photographs where people are trying on Afro wigs, was brought into the collection. And that meant a huge amount to me because I'd seen the original performance when I was a student. And it was done at Corner House in Manchester in, I think, 1994. And the really amazing thing was when I looked at the photographs, some of the technicians who had participated in the project, art handlers, and you know, the women and men who help install exhibitions, they still work in Manchester, and they'd worked for me at the Whitworth. And it's like, so I was seeing them when they were kind of in their early 20s. It was really lovely. But having like known Sonia's work since the early 90s, to bring a very big and important installation by her into the collection felt very, very important. I think one of the areas that we're looking at a lot at the moment, Russell, is it's actually not the contemporary, because of course, you know, from my academic background, I've always been interested in the past as well as the present. Mm-hmm. And Tate's responsible for 500 years of British art, as well as the 20th and 21st century in international art. So there's more we need to do to represent the early women artists. So 18th century women artists. Mm-hmm. We need to do more in the 19th century. And that will be slow because there's not a huge amount of work. But the kind of excitement that curators have when a work does become available and when we're able to correct some of that kind of historical imbalance is massive. Yeah. So last year, when it was marking 100 years of being able to vote for some women, we were able to bring in some of Emmeline Pankhurst's watercolours. And that was just fantastic.
Where had they been? How did you find them? Was the family looking after them all?
They were. It was exactly that, Russell. They had a small body of her work still within the family and understandably hadn't want to let that go. But with it being the 100th anniversary of suffrage and because it was Tate, they came to us and we had a discussion and they decided they were willing to let a small number of the watercolours come into the National Collection. And things, moments like that are just so important.
Are they political? Is they infused with that sort of energy, or are they, because of who she was, are they just works that she made by her?
I mean, she was an artist before she was an activist. And worked as an artist her whole life. So they are they're rather delicate and beautifully drafted, largely domestic paintings, quite small. But they document her her milieu, so the people that she knew and worked with, and also she did a lot of painting of the other women that she saw in the world. She did a number of tours around the country documenting women's labour. That's one of the works captures that, women at work.
Wow, amazing. So how is life now for the Tate? I mean, what is for every gallery around the world now that's closing or on a pause, and how do you project this time now when it's unprecedented of what, how to project into the future of where we're going to go?
Well, I mean, I think it's really difficult, and because it still feels very uncertain how long we will be in isolation, when we will be able to step back into our public role. But on the one hand, we're working with kind of vigor and optimism to make the most of our digital content. So this week we've just launched tours of the Warhol show and the Beardsley show, led by the curators, which we were able to film them at speed in the last couple of days before we closed down.
Oh, great.
But they're all still hanging up in there now, like a ghost town. They're all up.
Yeah,
like,
they are.
Yeah, well.
Yeah,
it's such a strange thing about the Warhol show as well, because I feel like that must have been, and Beardsley actually, because even Mark Gatiss, who we just interviewed, did a documentary on BBC, and there's been a lot of interest in his work at the moment. But I feel like with the Warhol one, that must be your like blockbuster, show, which I'm sure you have international tourists coming to and all that kind of stuff. So it must be such a kind of tough thing for you guys to have put all that effort into putting such a high profile show on and get those loans.
Yeah, it feels like a kick in the stomach, to be honest. And I said, I kind of dream about both of those shows, but especially the Warhol, because it had a week before closure, and this is marvelous room that's filled with silver kind of pillow sized balloons, and they kind of bounce around and you walk through them, and I keep thinking about, obviously the balloons are not inflated while we're closed, but I'm dreaming about these balloons kind of drifting around with nobody to bump into.
Oh my God.
Gregor and Fintan, who were the two curators that worked on that show, so worked with our digital colleagues to capture a tour of it just before we closed. The BBC were able to get in and film it. As you said, Mark Gatiss did that wonderful documentary on Beardsley. So in some ways, those things will reach a new and different audience in this time. Because different people will watch things on the television, and so many more people are looking for wonderful things to amuse themselves and to learn from while they're at home. And so we have to kind of seize that and say that is a really really good thing.
But you're hoping these shows will still be on for like when we get through this. Is there a world where this is seen as a pause and then we can just carry on from where we stopped?
Yeah, I hope so. And that's what, I mean, again, the teams behind the scenes have been planning multiple scenarios, depending on how long we're closed, because, of course, we don't know that yet. I really hope that people will be able to come back and see those shows. But they might not want to straight away come into large crowded spaces. So
yeah, that's the other thing,
we've been thinking a lot. Yeah. Because I think this will change all of our behaviour for quite a while. And we've been thinking a lot and talking to each other about what our purpose is after we're all able to sort of move beyond these restrictions. And I think part of our national role, if you like, is to help gently build people's confidence to come together again.
Wow.
And the good thing about a gallery or a museum is actually you're not crowded into a tiny space. You don't have to be. You can choose where you stand. You can choose how close or far away from a work of art you want to be, and you can take your own route. I mean, I often think about, I love some theatre, but I have a kind of existential problem with the theatre space, because I feel a bit uncomfortable with being told how long I have to sit still.
And,
and that's the contract in theatre. You know, it lasts this long. You have to sit still and look in this direction. Mm-hmm. Whereas I've always loved the visual arts more because, you know, you can choose to walk through an exhibition backwards. You know, we don't we don't rigidly force people to see things in an order. And you can like some parts and really dislike others. And I never mind people who say, oh, I only like this kind of art and I don't like that. I say, well, you know, I'm glad you know your own mind.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, in a gallery, you're in charge of your own time, aren't you?
Exactly.
Once you're in there.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so I think we're going to have a really, really important role to both give kind of creative inspiration to people, but also to build their confidence again, to be able to... be a part of the city again, or a part of the town that you're in.
Do you know what? I've not really even considered the psychological ramifications of this whole experience for people. That it's almost going to be slightly agoraphobic. It's like bringing on like enforced agoraphia, isn't it?
It could be long term as well. You know, there's something that you did when you were at the Whitworth, which I really loved as a kind of idea, was that there was a fence that was in between the park and the gallery.
Yes.
And what was it? Was it you? Was it your decision, or at least it was when you were there that you removed that fence so that the park and the museum became connected?
Yeah. I campaigned to the city and the police to get them to take down the fence because the whole thing seemed to me really bizarre. Because originally the gallery, the Whitworth and the park were created together and they were supposed to be a unified experience. There was this brilliant stuff in the early committee papers for the Whitworth from the late 19th century that talked about it being a gallery and a park for all social classes. And it's a fantastic phrase that we used again and again talking about the Whitworth's purpose was that the gallery was to be for the perpetual gratification of the people of Manchester. You think, well, you know, that's quite a good founding statement.
Amazing,
But in the kind of 90s and through the sort of that part of Manchester was hit quite hard in terms of post-industrial recession, and the park had been rather unloved and forgotten. And for reasons that nobody could properly explain to me, this very high fence had been erected around the gallery, cutting it off from the park. And as I said, you know, we stored the collection at the Whitworth, but there had been no evidence in the 125 years that the gallery was there that marauding hordes were going to come from the park and try and steal the collection. But it gave such a bad message to people. Mm. It really did say, go away, we don't want you here at this gallery. So it took quite a lot of persuading, particularly with the police. But I knew that we wouldn't be able to develop the Whitworth and we wouldn't be able to be properly engaged with our public unless we took this fence down. And so it was the first step towards then applying to the Heritage Lottery Fund for funds to extend the gallery and create two new wings that embrace the park and made a beautiful art garden that's open to people. And again, it goes back to that thing I was talking about around threshold anxiety, about what makes you frightened to step into these spaces of culture that are supposed to be for everybody. Mm. We wanted the gallery to be so much part of the park that you felt you could kind of step in without even thinking about it. And after we'd completed the extension and one wing had a beautiful cafe upstairs that kind of sat in the trees that ran alongside the gallery. And I sat one day, I was just having a cup of tea, and I saw a little boy on a scooter and he kind of pushed himself really hard. So he'd escaped from his dad and he came sailing down the path that led to the parkside entrance. And of course, there are automatic doors. And as he sailed along on his scooter, the doors opened and he scooted all the way into the gallery. And his dad was legging after him. And I just thought, that's it. We've achieved it. We've absolutely achieved what we set out to do.
So sweet.
Oh, Is there any fears at the moment with the shows being up? I know that security is amazing, but with that Van Gogh being stole the other day and all these museums
in
left
Amsterdam,
empty because
yeah.
Amsterdam, because everyone's had to kind of do a massive Mary Celeste experience on all the spaces. Mm. Is there a sort of fear of the protection of the art in there? And is there security guards in there and everything in place?
Yeah, and it's understandable that people would be concerned, but actually security in all the national museums is really, really exemplary. And we have amazing teams of people who are there 24 hours round. And of course, we're part of the wider effort in London as well. So at Tate Britain at the moment, the car parks behind the gallery, which are usually staff car parks, are being used for additional NHS staff who are coming in from outside London to help in the hospitals. Oh. And they need somewhere to be able to leave cars for 12-hour shifts. So we've given over our car parks to the NHS, which also just means there's more people around, which is a really good thing. And I'm really proud we've been able to do that. And we have lots of PPE equipment at the galleries because we work with chemicals, cleaning paintings, and, you know, we have estates management. And so we have the kind of the standard PPE kit. And really early on, after closure, the staff got together and worked out what we could give over to the NHS, and through the London Ambulance Service and hospitals in Liverpool, we kind of moved our stuff over to the people who need it.
Oh my God, you are a good thing, Maria Balshaw. Also,
Tate is a good thing.
Aside from that, you're also a qualified yoga instructor. Is that true?
That is true. I took my teaching quality. I never really intended to teach, although I have done a bit, because I wanted to understand my own and other people's yoga practice a bit more. And I learnt under an amazing teacher in Manchester called Andrea Everingham. And I have to say, one of the joyous consequences of these strange times is that my Manchester yoga studio, where I trained, has now moved all its classes online as Zoom classes. So in my Kent house, I'm able to do my Manchester yoga class again.
Amazing.
So going back to the idea of art heists, because Russell mentioned that Van Gogh that got stolen, we ask every guest two questions. And the first one is, if you could do an imaginary art heist, so obviously not a real one, or even just a touchstone artwork for you, if you don't want to steal something, because I guess you are a museum director. But but if you want to, if you have a touchstone artwork that really means something to you, what is that?
Yeah, I think I definitely can't be on record as wanting to steal an artwork, because that would cause me to be struck off as a museum director. but there is definitely a touchstone artwork. And, you know, I was lucky that I was able to work at the Whitworth with Cornelia Parker, Connie, as I know her, because she was one of my great heroes. And her work, Cold Dark Matter, which is the exploded shed and all its contents suspended in the air. That's in Tate's collection, which gives me great joy. But I saw
it's currently
it
in storage, isn't
it? It is in storage at the moment.
Yes. And it's quite a lot of storage.
The boxes are really, the cases are really beautiful. It's suspended by being hung on wires that hang from a kind of matrix above it, and all the objects are attached to these wires. And so when it arrived from Tate to the Whitworth, it's these very, very long crates, and each wire is laying down horizontally in a foam surround so that the objects attached are all kind of cushioned in layers down these crates. So you unpack it kind of strand by strand and gradually install it hanging from the frame above. But I saw that work when she first made it at Chisenhale in London. And I still remember a friend of mine said, I've heard this is like weird thing that's like an exploded room. I think we should go and see it. So we went off on a Saturday, and I didn't know who the artist was. I didn't know what I was really going to see. But when I walked in, I sort of remember this kind of thrill that was, oh my God, art doesn't have to belong in a frame. Mm. And I still, much later on, Connie told me that she'd gone to art school and started in painting and realized she wasn't very good at painting, didn't like it very much. And so she transferred to sculpture in second year. And then she said in a very, she's very self-deprecating. She said, that's why I make the kind of sculptures that I do, because I missed the first year. I don't know how to make the normal stuff.
Amazing. I mean, what is the uninstall for that? To install and uninstall, how long does that take? A few days, surely?
Yes, yeah. I mean, at the Whitworth, it took us 2 days to install and slightly longer to de-install, because it takes longer to put things carefully back into the crates.
And is there any plan for that to come back? I mean, how long do you have ideas in your head when things go into storage? How long they stay in storage, or is it just like, how does that work in like computing it all?
Yeah, well, we have a very, very good collections management database that keeps a track on where everything is and how long it's been in store. And some things need to go, and have people get often very upset about the works in storage, why they're not on show. But things like those beautiful drawings in the Beardsley show, if they were on show all the time, they would fade, and then they wouldn't be any good to us. Future generations would miss out. So works on paper, delicate watercolours, have quite limited time spans that they're able to be out before they have to have... I always think of them going back to sleep in their box in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
So we keep an eye on that so that we don't do any damage to the artworks. But then things like cold, dark matter are in great demand. So people might say, why is that not on show in Tate? Well, in 2014, the answer was because it's on show at the Whitworth in Manchester. Because Tate lends about 1,500 works a year go out across the nation and across the world. So Connie had a show in Sydney quite recently. So, we lend to Sydney. They have works by her in Australia. They might lend those to other parts of the world. Things are moving around all the time. So... Yeah. Sometimes they're not present in our Tate Britain rooms, but they'll be in Budapest or they'll be in Beijing. And that's a really, I always think that's a really great thing, because it's about sharing this artistic creativity globally.
With the world, yeah.
Yes,
but the simple answer to when will cold dark matter be up again is we're looking at it because Alex Farquharson, the director at Tate Britain, and his team are going to be rehanging all of the British collection, you know, the whole 500 years through 2021. I mean, the timescales might shift a bit now because of what we're living through, but 2021 into 22, rehang of the British collection. And so lots of things that haven't been on show for a while will come back out. Cold dark matter is always a tricky one. People adore it, but it does take up a whole room, and quite a large room.
Yeah, it's huge, yeah.
The other question we ask everyone is, what is your favourite colour and why?
Oh, green.
Mm-hmm. And you like a lot of colour, don't you? You're known for like wearing bright colours and fabrics and...
Yeah, clashing patterns and all of that. Green was an easy answer, and it's not related to my kind of visual arts career. It's so big. My dad trained as a horticulturalist. He did his degree at the Horticulture College just near where I live now in Kent, which was part of the University of London then. And so I grew up with plants around me, and I kind of understood how things grew and why you'd want to grow them without even thinking about it. So spring, my favourite season, the shooting green of the natural world around me at the moment just lifts my heart. But clashing colours also kind of really work for me. One of my great friends is the fashion designer Duro Aluwu, whose clothes I often wear. And I mean, he is Nigerian British and brings together those different traditions. So you get Liberty print alongside African pattern. And he once said to me, Maria, if in doubt, clash.
I have always
tried to live by that mantra.
Didn't you also have your wedding dress designed by Vivienne Westwood? Didn't that end up in a gallery show somewhere?
I got married in a very outrageous Vivienne Westwood dress, which was a sample. I so badly wanted this dress. It's beautiful pale blue jacquard, fake jacquard pattern with a mm-hmm. asymmetric kind of punk bustle on the back. Mm-hmm. I absolutely could not afford it. And I tried it on in the shop and it was a sample. And the lady went away to find out how much it would cost to have it made. And I was with my friend Helen and we were just falling about with giggles in the change room going, I'm never going to be able to afford this. And this rather marvellous assistant came back and said, I'm terribly sorry, but we have none of this fabric left. And, oh, well, you know, I was never going to be able to buy it anyway. And then she sort of had this fake solemn face and said, the thing is, now that the fabric is gone, we are able to sell the sample. And it proved to be a very, very extreme reduction. So suddenly the wedding dress became within reach.
That's
but
so cool.
The truth was that it was too small for me. I could not breathe in this bloody dress. and I just thought, well, I don't care. I'm going to lose a stone.
Yes, of course.
So right. I did. Because I was determined I was going to buy this dress. And As with so much of Vivienne's work, the tailoring and the structure of it is amazing. Mm. And she'd taken inspiration from 18th century dresses. And at that time, I was at Manchester Art Gallery, and there's a gallery of costume as part of the set of museums there. So Miles, the curator of costume, said, well, look, I've got this 18th century dress that Vivienne has used for inspiration. So can you lend us your dress so that we can make a show of the two things together? So that's what he did.
Amazing. I love that. So the other question we ask everyone, which we did in the minute because it's a Brucey bonus, is, Rob?
If you could encourage or have you rediscovered a hidden talent in lockdown?
I would encourage vegetable growing. It's not so much that I've discovered a hidden talent. I've always grown vegetables. But during normal life, I don't have time to raise things from seed. And, you know, you need warmth to get chilies and tomatoes and aubergines going early enough in the season that they'll then grow properly. But because I'm at home and I've got the heating on and in the kitchen, I've got tomato and chili and aubergine seeds, little plants all around me at the moment. So even if the lockdown goes on for a really long time, we're not going to be hungry in this part of the world. In fact, I think I'll have enough to have a little vegetable box scheme with my neighbours. So I would say to people, scatter some tomato seeds and see what happens.
Wonderful.
Oh, we love you, Maria.
Thank you so much.
I love you too. You ask very nice questions. Thank you.
Oh, good. Oh. No, of course. For everything we're talking about in today's episode, please look at our Instagram at TalkArt. And you're on Instagram as well, aren't you, Maria?
I am, yes.
What is your handle?
Do you know, I'm 50 years old. I can't remember my handle.
We're going to link to you anyway.
I'm sure Balshaw. It's Maria Balshaw. I really
and the Tates, all the Tates, obviously.
Basic name.
You're across
Tate
all the Tates.
Definitely on Instagram. Yeah.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Maria.
Thank
it's
you so
great.
Much, Maria.
And we'll be back very
thank
soon.
Thank you.
Thanks
Cheers.
For listening.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.